The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of the Spectator, and my guest this week is the comedy writer Joel Morris, whose new book is Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And very early on in this book, Joel makes the bold claim that he's going to tell us the secret to comedy. Joel, it is a bold claim. What set you out on the path that made you think you could?
I don't know. You've got to get the reader's attention early on. Yeah, I'd ended up, in order to prepare to do this, and obviously in order to have a career writing comedy, I'd read a lot of books about comedy. And very often they claim, sort of, I'll reveal the secret. And they often reveal the secret of a bit of comedy. And the most common one is they'll reveal the secret of stand-up comedy, which I think there is a definite like craft and a learned skill to. But they seem to fight shy of revealing the secret of comedy, how comedy works. And I thought, I think I have a sense of it because I've worked in the field for so long, and there must be a secret to it. Not necessarily a secret to how to write the perfect joke or how all jokes work, but there must be a system behind it, because there's a system behind lots of ineffable, inexplicable things. And also, I'd read a lot of books on how music works, and that seemed to be possible to explain to a certain level, and no one had tried it with comedy.
Well, what if the... Yeah, well, one of the things you said, ineffable. I mean, a peculiar thing that you point out very early on is that people are really resistant to the idea that what makes us laugh can be explained in technical or structural or historical or even evolutionary terms. That there's a kind of idea that it is something magic, and you'd say both serious and frivolous people.
Yeah.
Kind of unite in saying, oh, you can't look too closely at it. Why is that, do you think?
It's the naughty one, isn't it? I mean, that's the point. I mean, it makes sense to be able to analyse drama or a string quartet or something, because there's an academic edge to that, a seriousness around it. And the point with comedy is it's meant to be chaotic and frivolous and full of custard pies and misbehaviour and misrule. But I think there's rules to misrule, because the definition, I'm making this up on the fly. The idea of a misrule implies the idea of a rule. So you're clearly breaking something. And I think that I talk about it in the book, said that very often the people who are asked about how comedy works are either scientists who are fans and go, oh, it's inexplicable, I just love the delight of not knowing what's coming next, or they're critics or who are similarly fans, or they're practitioners of live comedy, and they don't want you to work out how it works, because it kind of spoils the joke. It's the magic circle. If someone tells you how it's done, will it spoil the magic? Whereas where I work, which is I'm a behind the scenes guy, almost everyone I know talks about how it works, because we have to, because it's our job. And it was just a sort of I wanted to talk about it more like a plumbing manual than a sort of a spiritual or artistic book, even though I do think it's an art. I wanted to sort of say, look, it's just about knowing where the stopcocks are and where these pipes connect up, because I think that's a lot of people who work in comedy, directors, producers, script editors, showrunners, do know how it works, but they don't tend to get asked. You tend to ask stand-ups because they're more famous.
That's your pen teller.
I felt that there was a lovely moment early on when I started doing this. I was at the Also Festival, which is a lovely festival up in Warwickshire, small ideas, books, thoughts festival that happens. I was up there, and you get booked alongside, you talk about comedy and silly stuff, and you get booked alongside things like neuroscientists and people who know about black holes and stuff. It's brilliant. And I was talking to a neuroscientist in a field with a pint, and he said, what are you working on next? And I said, I'm working on something about how comedy works. And he listened to me for a minute, and he went, you're going to say it's like stage magic and music, aren't you? And I went, yeah, that's what I was going to say. And he went, because that's what it is, isn't it? And I love the fact that he went, oh, so neuroscientists know. And he said, it's about, you think the coin's up one sleeve and it's up the other sleeve. He said, there are techniques to it. And he said, as a neuroscientist, I know what you're doing. You're tricking the brain by going one way and the other. And he said, that's the same as the delight of a good melody. You think it's going one way, it goes the other. And I said, yeah, that's exactly how it feels when I'm writing it and when I'm working in it. so maybe they're the same. And he went, well, that's a good avenue to go down. And it felt like a real vote of confidence from a proper boffin to say, look.
Well, I wish I'd found you a neuroscientist, because years ago when I was writing a book about rhetoric, I wanted to know why the rule of three, which also comes in comedy discussions, works. And I wrote to every neuroscientist I could find in the book saying, you know, why is it that we like things in groups of three? And nobody can.
It's funny, isn't it?
I mean, most of them didn't answer, but none of them had a satisfactory explanation. Well,
I got some very helpful neuroscientists and some scientists helping me with this book. And they're very cautious because they're peer review people. So they are very cautious about making sweeping statements about stuff. But I'm not. I'm a writer. I just try and make people laugh and think. So I can say silly stuff like, this is how rule of three works. You tend to find that academics tend to be slightly more cautious, whereas commentators, I'm writing about this in a sort of Bill Bryson-y kind of way, just going, well, hey, I'm kind of an interested practitioner within this. I don't need to have my stuff double checked with wires in the brain. But this is broadly what seems to be happening. Rule of three works because it's a pattern, I think. You can't perceive two things as a pattern. Four things is too many. You don't need four, you only need three. So rule of three, I think, tends to be just because one, two, three, you can break a pattern on three, can't you? Two blues and a white. I like seeing things abstractly like that. And I love that kind of thinking. And it was thinking about that and talking to neuroscientists about us as humans, as pattern detecting engines.
Well, that's a good way into what I think we just do before we get down to the technical stuff you talk about, which is fascinating to me. Maybe the science-y or the evolutionary stuff is, because obviously comedy covers a huge broad range of things, from stand-up to playground jokes to narrative comedy to sitcoms to all the different things you look at. But at root, there's this question of what we're doing when we deliberately make each other laugh. And you say there are kind of two things that are going on there. Is that right?
So generally, it seemed to, this came out of discussion with neuroscientists about the anthropology of it and why we do it. And we do it because it makes us happy. It's a social act. It's grooming. It's a brilliant thing. Robin Dunbar, the evolutionary anthropologist, said that eventually the groups that we gather in as humans became too big for us to pick nits off each other. The person you wanted to make happy was slightly too far away, beyond arm's reach. And when you get to the size of a village or something like that, which has humans' evolutionary advantages, we clump together in slightly bigger groups than lots of other animals so that we can organize ourselves and find roles for each other. So you're trying to make the tribe happy, and you're trying to do it. So you start using things like language. You can tickle. Maybe you can, which is what you see that apes and dogs will play fight. But we've got language, so we can put ideas in each other's brains at a distance. So yeah, the first thing we do is a social, there's a social function to comedy, which it makes you all feel nice. You're sharing your values. In order to make a joke, someone's got to agree with the setup of the joke. So you're making each other happy. And then the other thing we do, the other thing comedy's for, it's not just to make you feel socially part of a gang. It's to play games. It's Scrabble. It's Wordle. It's a game. It's a puzzle. The pattern detection engine in your brain is so sophisticated. It's how we combine the left and right eye images into three-dimensional reality. We look for patterns and differences and things. It's how we avoid tigers. There's a shape over there that shouldn't be over there. We're constantly pattern detecting. And what we like to do in our spare time, in our downtime, is take the engine that we're using all the time and do donuts in the car park in it. We take it to some skids. And I look at comedy as a sort of gleeful misuse of a piece of very high tech kit. And I say in the book, it's a bit like when you had a scientific calculator as a kid and you turn it upside down and write boobies on it. It's not meant for that, but it's brilliant to misuse a piece of very sophisticated technology to do stupid stuff with it.
Comedy remains something. I mean, maybe it's this social aspect of it that you're discussing. It means something that people get peculiarly angry about.
Yeah.
I mean, jokes are like right at the center of the wearying culture wars that we're currently, you know, fighting.
We've been told to fight, yes.
We've been told to fight. But, you know, as you say, people are deeply offended by jokes, and they're often offended and angry when someone else is finding something funny that they're not, even if it's not at their expense. Why is that? Why is it so connected to our emotions if it's just donuts in the car park?
This was something that I was interested in, because I wanted to start out doing. I'm a silly comedian. I write satire, but I still would say most of the satire I write is pretty silly. I know when we work with I do lots of work with Charlie Brooker, and we were far more interested in getting a really good crude your mum joke in than we were in taking the government down. It was at the level of I work for Viz. I like a good a bit of low abuse is much funnier than sharp satire for me. So I like silly and whimsical stuff. So I went to this book almost as a defense saying, I wanted to say jokes are silly, they're not toxic. And then slowly those bits of the book that were about the tribal social elements of comedy started to move closer and closer to the front of the book. They seemed to be more and more important. And the more I looked into it, I came to a conclusion that I didn't know I was going to be there. I look back at my notes afterwards when I didn't know that when I started the book. It was the journey I'd been on was that the social aspect of comedy isn't a mistake. The divisive aspect of comedy isn't when comedy's failed. I think it's when it's doing its job well. And there are some incredible jokes. I was talking to Dan Schreiber from QI recently, who said he'd think he'd worked out what the funniest joke was ever, as in the most laughter ever produced. And he went, it's Mr. Bean at the 2012 Olympics, the whole planet united watching physical comedy. And I went, yeah, but that's an absolute exception. Most of the time, comedy divides people into people who find it funny and don't. And it depends on the baggage you bring with you. Because comedy has to be done fast to trip you up and to fool you. Speed, timing, that whole thing. What's the secret of comedy? Timing. Deliver the joke fast. You deliver a joke really fast if people bring half of the joke with them. So what you're doing for your tribe, your little people, you're picking the nits off, is saying, let's say you're doing a joke about your favorite football team on a message board about your favorite football team. You do a joke about Blake Seven on some sci-fi nerd message board. You don't put all the information in the joke. You leave half of it out and people bring the rest themselves. People love that. And my friend, the comedy producer, Ed Morris, who used to do the news quiz, said we'd hit a point as the culture wars really embedded where people stopped objecting to the punchlines and started objecting to the setups. And I thought that was a brilliant point. You very often nowadays don't get to the middle of a joke before someone's turned off. And it used to be that it was the punchline, Mrs. Thatcher is evil, would be the thing that would turn people off and divide your audience in half, people who did think that and didn't think that. And now as you start a joke and you go, well, we all know Trump is a, half the audience just switch off because they don't agree with that. And it's meant that doing jokes to a big room gets harder as people's values are embedded in the assumptions they bring to a joke. So I think the problem, people say, oh, well, you can't joke about anything these days. I don't think you ever could. I think you're always playing to a partisan crowd, your home crowd. But now that home crowd, thanks to social media and mass media, will include everybody. So you go out on Radio 4, people forget that about accusations of bias. You do a joke on Radio 4, a political joke. The majority of Radio 4 listeners, despite the political thing, will be Daily Mail readers because it's a popular paper. And doing those sort of slightly left-wing, maybe liberal jokes to them, it's going to go down badly. The people in the theatre will laugh and people at home will get cross because they'll go, I feel excluded. There's nothing more miserable than other people laughing when you don't find it funny. And it's just because a joke will mark you out as outside a tribe. And that's a distressing thing. It's a real playground feeling of, but I don't find that funny. So I think it's part of how jokes work. And when people say, is this a new thing? Or I don't think it is. I think it's inherent in the form. It's a tribal form, comedy.
The basics that you describe of how jokes work, and we'll kind of look into those in a bit more detail in a second, are kind of absolutely sempiternal. I mean, is there nothing new under the sun with comedy, or have some of the forms we've produced and invented kind of effectively changed? You know, have we got new vessels for this old wine?
I must admit, that was the thing that I was delighted by. I don't think we have. I love finding an old joke that still makes me laugh. I did, when I was at college, I did English at college, and I did things like Arthurian myth and Anglo-Saxon and things, and I found jokes in there that would still work. One of the great hidden secrets about Monty Python and the Holy Grail is that most of the jokes in there are from Arthurian literature. They're in Chrétien de Troyes. They're a knight whose limbs come off and keeps fighting a vampire rabbit. Most of those jokes would still work in a different form for a medieval audience, because the human brain hasn't evolved a terrible amount in a few thousand years. So the tricks you're playing on it to fool it, in the same way as I don't think fundamentally there's, you can enjoy medieval music, the notes are the same, and you can enjoy a magic trick from a long time ago. It's playing the same tricks on your brain. So I think that what comedy is basically doing changes. But what will change, again, is the baggage you bring to it. So you can read a Victorian novel and not get any of the jokes, but that's just because you don't commute to work in a carriage. There's a great observation someone made that there used to be loads of jokes about seasickness, and we don't joke about seasickness anymore because we don't take many long boat journeys. We talk about airline food. There are cultural specifics to each era, and you'll go, so you'll read an old joke and go, oh, that's not funny. But what it is you haven't brought the baggage with you. You're the wrong crowd. And I think very often when we look at jokes, we go, that's the wrong joke. Whereas actually what we should be saying is that's the wrong tribe, the wrong crowd. You're from a different fire. You should be huddled around a different fire. And I think that's, I think the joke shapes are the same. And they go across so many different forms that I think what is happening to you when you understand or listen to or laugh at a joke must be the same as it was in Roman times, I think.
Now, another great shibboleth of kind of comedy cliche, which is that, you know, comedians love to think that what they're doing is dangerous. And you say, absolutely not. Jokes are not dangerous. Jokes are safe. That what makes something comedy is actually, you know, sorry, Bill Hicks. Is not that it isn't a kind of great, you know, vital telling truth to power and assault on whatever proprieties and hypocrisies it claims to be an assault on. How do you make that case?
This was one of the bits of the book I sort of stumbled into while I was working out what jokes were and how comedy works. And it surprised me because I always liked that. I'm a big fan of, I love Bill Hicks. I like George Carlin pushing things, Lenny Bruce pushing things. I love Chris Morris and Peter Cook and saying things they're not meant to say. But the more I analysed what, it was trying to get the science of explaining why we're laughing in groups, in social groups, what that is, alongside my love of comedy history and my love of celebrating these great risk takers. And it's just that noise, laughter. And it's something that it came out of discussions with some neuroscientists about this, about how we react to horror and how we react to comedy are really similar. And lots of comedy people do great work in horror, sort of Jordan Peele, Mark Gatiss-y kind of thing, where you use the same techniques to get reactions. And in one of them, you're tense and you scream. And in the other one, you laugh. And I thought, well, hang on, if it's the same 1, 2, 3 surprises, why are you screaming in one and laughing in the other? And then tried to work out what a laugh was. And I thought, a laugh is, and this theory has been around since Victorian times, a release of tension. It's what Freud said it was. It's what relief theory says it is. It's the steam that's built up is released. And in horror, the steam is sustained. And you either hold your breath or you scream to release it, usually at the end of a long period of sustained terror. And it was realizing that a laugh is a release of tension. And you go, well, hang on, well, why are people laughing when this is supposed to be dangerous? And then you look at it as a tribal thing and you go, they're laughing because they feel safe, that the comedian has said the unsayable. Yeah, that's dangerous for the comedian if you're in a dictatorship or a censorship or a place where you'll be disapproved of. But actually the people who are laughing, oh, thank God he said it. Thank God he said the king has no clothes. And so I just wrote down, I went out for drinks with everyone I knew in comedy and said, name me a dangerous joke. And then took it back and put them in categories and went, well, that's, and tried to work out where, if you look the other way and didn't look at the sexy danger, looked at the safety, could it be seen as a mark of safety? And all of them could be seen as a way of saying, don't worry, we're fine. Even a nervous laugh is a way of trying to encourage someone else to join in and go, we're okay, aren't we? The way David Brent laughs is I've said something, I think I've done something wrong. If I laugh, maybe if you laugh with me, then we're all safe. They were mainly laughter was being used as an anesthetic, as a soothing process. It was all about the tribal grooming, the picking the nits off, that we've gathered together to agree that Jerry Sadovitz is our guy. Now, whatever he says, the problem comes when someone in that room doesn't feel safe and then they leave the tribe and very often go to the New Statesman and complain, or on the internet and complain.
These are those woke snowflakes.
Yeah, the peril is that someone says, I didn't find that funny. And that could be anybody. But all they're saying is, I wasn't part of the tribe. I didn't feel safe in this. And the moment you start looking at comedy and where danger and safety line up in things like bullying and teasing, I got really interested in that as a thing going. Very often at the most primal level, people talk about laughter and comedy and it's about bullying and teasing and prank. And I went, oh yeah, but the person who's being picked on doesn't feel safe. And you look at who's laughing and you go, well, it's the people who feel safe because they're not being picked on, the relief of that. And sometimes someone who's been picked on will laugh to say, hey, don't worry, I'm still part of the gang. The ways people laugh tell you where they are in a network of safety and danger. And I think that the danger and the risk is very often extrinsic to the comedy, because you can paint a piece of art on a wall that isn't remotely funny, that challenges power. You can write a very serious dramatic play that challenges the status quo. So challenging the status quo isn't part of comedy because you can do it seriously. You can just shout at someone across the street. You can just go piss off. That's not a joke. That's just shouting. The comic technique seems to be, to me, anchored to that feeling of relief and safety, tribal bonding, feeling, togetherness, warmth. And it's not sexy to say that. So I think I'm probably, of all the things I'm saying this, but that might be the only dangerous thing is me insisting that comedy isn't dangerous. Because I think people like the idea.
It'll be dangerous for you and your comic tribe.
Yeah, because they're all going to go, but what we're doing is really rebellious. In fact, I've had that. I've had a lovely sort of rouse of people going, yeah, it is. And I'm going, I don't think it is. I think you're making yourself feel nice. It's the only reason. Why would you do this? Otherwise, we'd all be screaming all the time. Cheers is filmed before a traumatized audience. They do it. They'd set the building on fire before a sitcom. They don't. If you talk to any actor, the first thing a stand-up or an actor does to perform comedy is try and make the audience feel reassured and confident and safe and warm. And if you've ever tried to perform comedy to a room full of people who've just been through the BBC's baggage check for the radio theatre, where they feel like you're in the middle of a terrorist outrage, no one's feel safe when they sit down. The first three sketches of a BBC radio recording go terribly because everyone's on edge. You need to get everyone with a drink inside them and have them feel they're in their gang, and then everyone will laugh. That's why you laugh with your friends and your family, and you those are the warmest laughs, where you feel completely looked after. And that can include a group of people who've been to see the most scabrous, amazing comedian who pushes the boundaries, and you feel like you're in your tribe, like you've gone to see an amazing punk band and you all agree they're amazing. But you feel brilliant. As a teenager, I was into thrash metal. In the middle of a mosh pit is where you feel safest. People punching. It feels great.
If memory serves. now, the structure of jokes and it was a sort of central point of this book, which I found really interesting, is, again, you're sort of slightly shifting our expectations, because one of the clichés is to say, comedy is all about surprise.
Yeah.
You know, you're always surprised, you're always wrong-footed, and obviously we can produce endless examples of how puns and various other jokes work that way. But you're saying something a bit more subtle than that, and that there are, you say there are three different keys on your clown keyboard.
Yeah.
And just three, which is...
Yeah.
Or there's one you should never hit, but... You know. Explain the clown keyboard, because this is kind of seems to be at the centre of your book, and I find it very...
Well, it was
interesting and surprising.
It was one of those tempting ideas. I said this once at a talk I gave about writing short jokes, and I said, as we all know, there's only three keys on the clown keyboard, and the whole room just went blank. And I thought, oh, I think I've thought of that on the fly. I thought I'd heard that somewhere, and I checked, and it was one of those extemporized ideas, and I went, I'm probably gonna have to explain this. And then when I started talking to people about it, I thought, it's probably a book to explain that. It's a bigger idea than I thought. And it was, whenever people talk about comic techniques and they try and deconstruct it, you end up with a great list of different things you're doing, like sort of reversals and subversions and exaggeration and bathos. And I thought, well, all these things, maybe there's fewer of those keys than you think. And the conclusion I came to was that there was only three things you were ever doing with a joke, which was construct, confirm, and confound. And those are the only things you ever do. You're constructing, you're saying what's going on, you're telling people where the joke's set, a man walks into a bar, whatever. Confirm is he says something to the barman that someone would normally say in a bar. So, oh, right, we're still in a bar, pattern. And then confound is then the barman says something funny that you wouldn't expect in a bar. Why the long face to a horse or whatever? And the first two say, this is where we are. Don't worry, that's where we are. You know what comes next. And the third one says, it's not where you think, which is brilliant. That explains a hell of a lot of one, two, three jokes. That's the rule of three. The rhetorical rule of three is group things in threes. Education, education, education. I came, I saw, I conquered. Snap, crackle, pop. The comedy rule of three tends to be set up, development, punchline. But it was bothering me that I could think of loads of jokes that didn't have setup, development, punchline. They didn't have one, two, three in it. But when I broke it down, what they were doing is they were still playing one of those three notes. And the big one for me was reassuring comedy, warm comedy. Why do you enjoy watching the first half hour of an Ealing comedy where it's just warm, reassuring? It's clearly comic, but it's actually just people behaving in a way that you recognize and adore. All you're doing then is confirming. Most of the jokes in a sitcom are Captain Mannering behaving exactly like Captain Mannering would behave, Kramer being like Kramer, Trigger being like Trigger. Basil Fawlty is always being Basil Fawlty. The only time Basil Fawlty ever confounds you is when he's too Basil Fawlty. So it's basically the marching up and down, doing the goose step in front of the Germans is a confound. It's surprising. But then it's completely in character. It confirms. There's a warmth of recognition that is... one of the triumphs of comedy craft is to tell you where you're going and then go there and people be delighted by it. And that made me think that the confound key, the third of those, is only one of the three. You can get a joke, you can get a laugh out of the construct key if you want to. And you can definitely get a joke out of the confirm key by saying either a character behaves exactly as expected, or my favorite versions of those are the, you know, the repeated jokes like no one died, no one died, no one died, and this is day to day, or Steve Coogan going Dan, Dan, Dan across the car park, Alan Partridge. There's no surprise there, apart from how long it's going on. You know what he's going to say next. He says it and you go, hurrah. And all you're doing with those three keys is setting up and breaking patterns. And you can set up and break patterns in loads of ways that aren't just one, two, twist. And it's the first time I'd sort of broken something down and thought, hang on, I think I can see what's going on at quite a deep level with the units of data in a joke, to get super nerdy. It doesn't always have to be a surprise. And it certainly doesn't have to be, I mean, you can do one, twos, you can do construct, confound. So yeah, it suddenly went, oh, actually, hang on, I think that's what we're doing. We're making and setting up little pattern games for you to guess what's coming next. And you can do two things then. You can either deliver what people expected and they will be happy, or you can surprise them and they will be happy as long as you played fair.
And playing fair involves, for instance, you know, if it's character comedy, that whatever surprises them is nevertheless decipherable in terms of the character.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of confounding, but confirms at the same time in a deeper way.
You have to reverse up. I mean, it's the same thing as you do in a pun. I mean, that's what I loved about it. As soon as I started looking at this, I went, oh, well, this explains not only something Phoebe would do in Friends, but also how a cracker joke pun works. You're tripped over and you reverse to check that you why you went wrong. And it turns out to be fair because the word has two different meanings or whatever. And the same thing, Joey in Friends wears all of Chandler's clothes. That's a mad thing to do. Actually, rewind. No, that's exactly what Joey would do in that situation. So now you're laughing. They didn't play unfair. It would be really weird if Monica had done that. It's a perfect Joey joke. It's that thing. The joke belongs to characters. And that seemed to explain something that is always taught in comedy writing things about all jokes come from character. And you went, or you could just say there's only three notes you can play on the comedy keyboard.
Yeah.
Don't cheat people. Make sure you've given them the information. It's another reason why we struggle to enjoy episode one of a lot of comedies. Why it's such a skill to do it, because you don't know who the characters are yet, so they can't confirm. The opening scene of a sitcom, especially American ones, is done at such a high level of skill to make sure that you feel you already know everyone on beat one of scene one of the first scene of Cheers.
Are there good examples of that you can think of? That
Cheers is incredible. I mean, Cheers is incredible. Actually, the thing to watch is watch any modern American sitcom, because the great thing about the American pilot season, the thing where they make too many comedies, is that everyone in American comedy has written thousands of episode ones. You'll notice that sometimes they're not very good at episode four, but they are amazing at episode one. It's sharpened their skills at setting up characters really quickly. And you'll see it in anything. Is the opening scene of the people talk about the opening six lines of Friends contain six jokes, six elements of character detail, and by scene two of Friends, you know who those guys are. It's a masterclass. American sitcoms are almost better at it than anybody. But yeah, actually, a good British sitcom will do it. You'll know within seconds of the opening of Fawlty Towers who Basil is. And then you can start playing games on it. And it's the analogue with sitcom, which I really like, is because sitcom explains, again, that social aspect. What you're sharpening in your mind is your ability to enter a strange house or a wedding or a workplace and get the measure of everyone really quickly and then get on with them. It's social training. And we love doing these little sort of shuttle run exercises of guessing what a character's going to do next, because we need to use that all the time because we're social animals. We need to get the measure of people. And sitcom is an astonishing workout for that bit of the brain, much faster than drama.
Yes, I was interested in something you said, I remember a couple of weeks ago. You were kind of annoyed that the bear had received all these awards for comedy. And you said it's not a comedy.
No, you can find it funny, but it's not.
And you had an absolutely kind of, you know, crystalline explanation for the difference between comedy and drama that I'm thinking, that's far too simple to be right. But then running up, trying to find counterexamples and not very much being able to. Can you?
Yeah, I stumbled upon this really, really late. I was having a chat about what was in the book with a friend who's an editor. He's a film editor. He does documentaries. But he's obviously really, really good at story because of that. He finds stories in random heaps of footage of data. So he's really good at that. I said, well, I think what it is speed, as in there's a real speed. You've got to get a joke every three lines or so-and-so in comedy. So basically, you've got to set up and pay off really quickly. No one's got any patience in comedy. It's why people get 15 minutes and something, go, didn't make me laugh, and turn it off. Whereas you'll watch six seasons of a detective series and go, didn't like that. But watch six seasons of it. People's expectation of the pace of drama is different. And we talked about this, and I said, I think this is, again, to go back to the anthropological metaphor for it, I think that drama is about waiting, that you're given tiny drips of data. Think about a detective drama as almost the platonic form of certainly in peak TV. There's someone's been killed, who killed them, who done it, what's going on, the mystery, whatever it is. And you'll wait. You'll wait and you'll wait and you'll wait. And characters in that can behave completely out of character, and you go, they're mysterious. I'll find out why she did that in season two. If Phoebe behaves out of character in Friends, you go, this is badly written. But you will watch someone behave, because in drama, people are concealing motive. Stuff's below the surface. Whereas in comedy, for you to laugh, you have to know the characters. So they have to reveal themselves constantly. The audience has to know who everyone is. And once you spot that, you go, actually, the data is being dropped out in different rates in drama and in comedy. And the opening episode of The Bear, I didn't know anything about him. It was a mystery. That's not how you set up a pilot. A pilot episode of a sitcom, he'd tell you about his relationship, his family, everything straight away. So you'd go, I know what you're going to do next. And I didn't know what the guy was going to do next, which made it was terrific drama. But it didn't tickle the part of my brain that I could do the little shuttle runs of pattern detection you can do with a comedy. Conversely, something like Succession, which is wins loads of drama awards and has drama bones, is basically made like a sitcom. You know those guys straight away. They're completely unchanged almost for four seasons. They will never get out of their trap. It's a wonderful family sitcom. It's a bit Arrested Development kind of super rich family sitcom. It is classy. It is 100% dramatic, but it has comedy bones in it. Slow Horse is the same way. Better Call Saul. They've got this dashing, quick delivery of confirmation of character data. But my friend who's the editor said, what you're saying is that drama is an art form that teaches us to wait and look carefully, because we might not know anybody. They might reveal secrets. They might not be who they say they are. Don Draper might not really be Don Draper. Maybe the butler did it, but I'll wait because I need to watch. And it's kind of the part of your brain that would wait for the wildebeest to come in, or the sun to rise and set, if you're the caveman version of you, to watch long data gathering, patience, Chris Packham in a hide waiting for something. Whereas comedy rewards you for knowing people. And comedy is a form that tells you you can know people. You know the people you know. And it feels like that when you finish the hunt and you come back and you're all sitting around your fire, comedy's the bit that went, typical Jeff. Jeff always does that. And you get that lovely warm buzz of, I guessed exactly what Jeff was going to say. And I know Jeff, and Jeff never lets me down. And I think both of those things are so valuable for us as humans. We need to know both of them, that it annoys me when people go that one is better than the other. Waiting a long time for hidden data is somehow better than having your data integrity checker constantly rewarded. Hang on, what you're saying is drama is better than comedy. I think they're sort of, they work well together, but they're different bits of the same pattern detection in the brain. I love the fact that you need both of them. So I find it annoying when someone goes, if you're getting quick yucks off something, it's not as deep as waiting. And I think you need both, don't you?
Yeah. There are sort of hybrid forms. I'm wondering what you think about, you know, someone like Dickens or even Shakespeare would include absolutely, you know them through and through sort of two-dimensional comic characters.
Yeah. See, I'd argue they're not two-dimensional. I think one of the things about it, people say that. So I think a good comic character is totally three-dimensional, but they're just delivering all the data really fast. They're not hiding anything. I think we mistake hidden depths for depths. there's enormous depth in Alan Partridge, and you know exactly who he is.
Yes. No, yeah, okay.
I'm just defending, I'm just defending the comic character there. I think.
But there are unchanging,
yeah.
You know, all the information's out there, characters who coexist in a Dickens story with characters who are mysterious, characters who are going to change, characters who are going to develop and keep our attention for a long time. They kind of coexist in those two registers in one dramatic unit.
Yeah, I think it's because humans are good at both those things. And I think that I find, as someone who's a really big fan and an advocate of comedy, if I find I watch something that doesn't have that Dickensian ability to also deliver quick shuttle runs of information and joy, if I'm just meant to sit seriously and watch something brood at me, I go, part of my brain feels a bit like I can hear it being switched off. And I like both of them. Dickens and Shakespeare did it brilliantly. But at the beginning of Shakespeare's career, you stop scenes for comic relief scenes. And the drama stops. As Robert McKee said, it's just something funny happens. By the time you get to Much Ado or King Lear, the comic characters are completely integrated within the story and are part of the story. And that's a sophistication that we've stuck the two masks from the theatre together. And you get Better Call Saul that way. You get Breaking Bad that way. You get The Sopranos that way. These great marks of the best drama and art that we produce have that comic thing. I sometimes treat the first laugh I get in a drama as a demonstration that the people making it know what they're doing, because I might have to wait an hour or two or three or two series to find out whether they can land the answer to the mystery. But if you show me if you get me laughing, a character sort of does something set up and then pays off their character and confirms my suspicions of them in a delightful way. That amazing scene in the pilot of Better Call Saul, where he finds the skateboarders who are trying to do the scam on him. And he's explaining, and you go, this is just straight from a sitcom. And what you're doing is you're doing a little demo on the keyboard. You're running the keyboard's demo settings to say, everything's working. Don't worry, we've got this. We can make you laugh. Sopranos, there's one of those almost straight away. Anything that shows, don't worry, stay around for the long haul, because I can definitely do the job. And I regard in the integration of comic characters and comic scenes within drama as a mark of someone just showing they can do the full set of stuff. Succession's amazing for that.
Yeah, something interesting you say, which kind of bears on this a bit, is that if you're watching a comic movie, the plot has nothing to do with comedy.
Yeah, usually.
Which is a would be a surprise, I'd have thought, to a lot of listeners. It was a bit of a surprise to me to think, oh, really?
There might be one comic idea in the plot. It's a really hard earned lesson, and I make the mistake all the time. I still make the mistake when I'm plotting things. I go, actually, I do think that it needs to be, they need to be robbing a bank, they need to be getting away from a monster, they do need to be on the run. The gangsters in Some Like It Hot are going to kill them. The moment you turn off the heat of reality, I watched the Lavender Hill Mob a couple of days ago, and there is no doubt those guys are going to prison for the thing they're doing, which is a silly caper, a proper Ronald Searle cartoon caper with comic schoolgirls and novelty Eiffel Tower paperweights. Everything about it is silly, apart from the central plot, which could be from a crime thriller. The Knights of King Arthur really want the Holy Grail. Brian is really caught up in 33 AD Jerusalem. He's in terrible, terrible trouble. The temptation to make the plot silly takes all the heat out of something, but Harry and Sally getting together is vitally important for those people. And it's a thing I did a bunch of crime spoofs, did Touch of Cloth for Sky and wrote lots of, I've done stuff like that. And always the temptation is to go, oh, it's a marmalade accident. It's nothing real. It's about a cake stall at the WI Fate. No, it's got to be a murder. You've got to have a real murder. And then Leslie Nielsen in The Naked Gun or in The Police Squad is investigating real crimes. And it really surprised me to find it out. Yeah, the stakes have to be high. Otherwise, the motor goes out of the thing. And it's very important for Basil to run a really good hotel. It's important.
It's important to him.
Yeah, yeah.
Though I think you say, which made me, that the makers of Airplane took an absolutely straight bad disaster movie plot and stole it so thoroughly that they actually had to buy the rights. Is that
it's line for line. Look it up. If you look up on YouTube, and this is one of the great joys of being alive in the digital era, look up Airplane 0 hour comparison. 0 hours, the original 50s film. And they've got them side by side, and it's line for line. And what it is, and the joy of finding this out about Airplane, is they are doing, the guys who made it, the Zucker Abrahams team, are doing what you do with a sibling watching a bad film, which is you're finishing the lines off. It's Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's Beavis and Butthead. They are putting the final line in the mouth of the serious guy. It's one of the clues to the fact that Airplane is a 50s Air Force movie brought into the, was it 1979, brought to the modern era, is that there's a jet and you can hear prop engines all the way through it. The sound effects of 0 hour had to be on there as well, because that's what they were used to. So they put propeller plane engines on it, even though it's a jet, because all the way through it, because that's what they talked over the first time they were taking the piss out of it. So they had to buy the rights to it. And we did it for when we did Touch of Cloth, we bought a Boris Starling script for Messiah that hadn't been filmed. Bought it off Boris. It's a great script. And then took the piss out of it. And the second one, I think we wrote the script ourselves. But we had to write a straight Guy Ritchie gangster drama first. And then kind of scribble over it. It's an honourable tradition. It's new words to a school hymn. It's drawing dicks on the school RE book. It's a high art. It's very viz. But yeah, you're
no high calling.
Yeah, it's, at best, it's the Baron Knights. It's rude words to a song. You know, there's a fundamentally it's misrule again. You've got a serious thing, and you're not taking it seriously. Weirdly, the spine of a serious thing gives you a brilliant wall to push against or to bounce your comic balls off. But the more solid that wall is, and the more the audience know what's meant to happen next, it's a serious disaster movie, the straighter bat you play, the funnier it gets. It's not just Leslie Nielsen playing a straight bat. The whole film is deadpan, and it makes it so much funnier.
Now, speaking of serious matters, and leaving aside for a moment the kind of culture warsy stuff about you can't say anything, I'm interested in what your thoughts are about the way in which, because reading your book and, you know, the sort of structuralist points you made and the discussions you made of how a comedian presents a persona and develops it and confirms or confounds the audience's expectation, it made me think a lot of the work I've done on rhetoric and the connection between comedy and politics and public life, because so much of this is about identity and creating and shaping and grooming identities and crowds. I remember reading a thing that was, I think it was Vox, about 5 years ago, got a bunch of linguists to analyse Trump's very unusual rhetorical style. And they said he talks much more like a stand-up comic than he does like anything else.
100%. It's a friend of mine who's a really big wrestling fan, when Trump got in, said, you just need to know that he hosted WrestleMania. He's a cartoon character. He's an action figure. He's a Saturday morning cartoon guy. He is delivering at a really fundamental level like a well-loved sitcom character. He can't let you down. Boris Johnson did the same thing, created a comic persona that he couldn't disappoint his fans with because it's always classic Trump. There is a terrific, I recommend this just because it's one of the most savage things I've ever seen. Tim Heidecker, American anti-comedian, did Tim and Eric's show, which is a great, if you like Vic, it's like an American Vic and Bob, like a really strange but very American thing. And he does a stand-up special. I think it's on YouTube. It's called Tim Heidecker Stand-Up Special. And it's a very alpha, slightly Bill Hicks, leather-jacketed stand-up. And there's something unsettling about it. There's no material. He does an hour with no material, just crowd work. He's poured all the content out of it. And he described that routine as Trumpian. And when you realize that, you watch it and you go, yeah, it is. He's just got the crowd on side and they are with him and they are fans and he's got a cult fan base. So they're with him for this. And he does an hour with no material through which you can glimpse his terrible home life, that's what we all reckon right kind of delivery. And you suddenly realize you've heard that everywhere, not just in stand-up, not just in that affirmation and cuddling of your shared values, but you've heard it at party conferences and at rallies. And it's really chilling to realize that it's the same technique. But then it's not surprising because the audience is a selected group of humans, same as a comedy club. And it's one of the things I think that gets misunderstood when people object to comedians' politics, is they don't, again, we're back to the disagreeing with the setups, not the punchlines, is you go, you've got to agree with the general values of a comedian or a politician in order to understand or even what they're saying. Because a lot of the notes of agreement are unvoiced. You brought them in with you. We all agree women are like this, men are like that. We all agree that people from Scotland are like this. Or those are the richest jokes because they happen quicker. You can miss out a beat of explanation. You can get straight to the gags and those shared assumptions. I remember watching Billy Connolly do a late routine, and obviously Billy Connolly is superb. And he hit a point where I disagreed with his politics. It was just an old man rant about health and safety. And it was something like, people used to get run over by vans in my day and it never did me any harm. And I thought, that's so stupid. So I stopped laughing. I went, I've stopped laughing at Billy Connolly. And every gag was right. But I didn't agree with the proposal, the general idea. I went, no, health and safety is a good thing because it means kids aren't getting run over. And I was so busy disagreeing with the setup, I stopped listening to his jokes and went, oh, you've lost me. Whereas almost every other beat of the routine had got me. And you suddenly realize it's really easy to stop laughing if you don't agree with the initial setup. And it's really easy to laugh if you do agree with all the original initial setups.
Well, conversely, something you were saying that I was struck by just about this anti-comedian, who said he kind of essentially evacuated it of content.
Yes.
And towards the very end of your book, you discuss talking to a female comedian who said, you know, I kind of wonder why I'm doing this, because I know that I just have to get the rhythms right and the intonations right and the body language right, and it doesn't really matter what I'm saying. Why don't I bother writing new material? I mean, and you compare it very much to music. I mean, can you essentially, you know, is comedy something that can be more or less evacuated of its content?
I think so. I think it's telling that the comedians do. I mean, Tim Heidecker is a perfect comedians comedian, and someone like that. The people who are Barry Cryer's jokes, his comedians jokes that Barry Cryer would always tell, were the ones that he said left the general public floundering, confused. His Shaggy Dog stories with no proper endings about men with half a head that's an orange. A Shaggy Dog story is a joke you tell to other people who understand jokes. Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road is a joke you tell to other kids who understand jokes to say there's no joke in there. There's bits missing from it. Evacuating the content is a secret that comedians share with each other, because we do know that the rough rhythms of something do work. In the same way as the example I always use in the book is Louie Louie. The lyrics are meaningless, but what a tune. You're compelled by the beat and the rhythm, and the way that those three chords go together is enough. And there is a lot in common. You can do empty content if you're at your worst and most hack, and most comedians will admit they've been tempted to do that. But then that also means that you can take those melodies and chord patterns and rhythms that drive comedy and put anything on top. So that's probably key to my argument in the book, saying that you could choose to do a different joke. You could change the lyrics, because effectively Bob Dylan's melodies and nursery rhymes are the same, and one's very deep and affecting and the voice of a generation, and one's Bar Bar Black Sheep. Hey Mr. Tambourine Man isn't that far away from that, but no one would argue that that's a thing that people don't understand, is that it's still G, D and A. It's just three chords. And I think that understanding the three chord structure of comedy robs some of the more problematic ends of comedy from the thing of, I had to say that joke because it was funny. And you went, yeah, you could have changed anything in that joke and it still would have been funny. So you chose, I mean, own it, for God's sake. If you wanted to offend everybody, it's not that you couldn't help it. You could put anything in there. You could make a joke for 5-year-olds that would go over the same shape as that. The shapes are the same. So I believe in the sacred solid chord structures of jokes. And I think that the best people then realize that means they can put anything in there and they can do something startling with it. They can change people's minds. It sets a very high bar once you know that, because then the duty is to do something excellent. And maybe that's what frightens people, because you could change the world. But I mean, most people, but you can also just tickle people. They're both options.
Well, I want to just ask you about this one example in the book, which just made me howl, which was it was a Stan and Ollie joke.
Oh.
Where you say, if you're skilled enough, you can confuse the audience, because you're saying don't confuse the audience all the time. But can you tell us how Stan and Ollie got away with confusion?
It's a brilliant one. And once you've spotted this, because I sort of say that there are three notes you can play. There's a fourth note, which is confused, which is really easy to hit, which is basically your setup leads somewhere the audience couldn't possibly guess where it was going. And most of the time, the audience just get cross. But if you're a skilled enough practitioner, you can play it like, I said, like Les Dawson playing the piano. You can hit the bum note and everyone knows you meant to hit the bum note. But you really need to prove that you're a skilled practitioner first. That then, I say, it's like the howl of feedback off a guitar. It's a horrible noise, but you know that Jimi Hendrix meant to do it. So it then becomes delightfully rackety and noisy. And they're one of my favorite ones, because Stan Laurel, as a writer and a constructor of jokes, is just so bright and so clever and so ahead of his actually not even ahead of his time. This is classic Victorian joke writing. This is something he would have learned on the music hall. And there's a Laurel and Hardy short called Me and My Pal. And Ollie's about to get married. And the setup is, the radio says, Mr. Oliver Hardy is about to marry a very rich heiress. And Stan comes round to be his best man for the wedding and is being deliciously annoying and the agent of misrule. And Ollie does a classic, Stanley, you've got to take this seriously. I'm marrying this guy and her dad is the biggest magnet in the state. And there's a little pause. Your brain goes, I know where this is going. You do know what a magnet is, don't you, Stan? Yes, I sure do. They eat cheese. And you go, I was probably two beats behind that with Iron Filings, Attract Metal, Stick to Tin Cans. And Stan, I don't know, but because Stan is a magical sprite with a brain that's full of soup, a Father Dougal character, a bubble from Abfab, it's completely in character that he thinks a magnet is a mouse. Is his brain filed alphabetically? I mean, it's so lovely. If Ollie had done that joke, it wouldn't have worked. It's so confusing, but weirdly so in character. And I love those jokes. It's why is a raven like a writing desk from Alice in Wonderland? Yes, of course, the Mad Hatter's joke has no answer. It's just mad. It doesn't make sense, but it doesn't spoil the joke because it belongs to that character. I love that.
Joel Morris, thank you very much for your time. And listeners, there are an awful lot more good gags like that in this fascinating book. Thanks a lot, Joel.
Thank you.